Okay. So we are continuing from last week where we spent some time talking about Vashti. We talked about the background of the story. We talked a little bit about Ahasuerus, maybe more than a little bit. We talked a little bit about Haman and a little bit about Esther. The big shift that's going to take place between last week and this week is the shift really between Vashti to Esther, where Esther becomes much more of the person who will interest us. But I think part of what I was trying to show last week was that in order to really understand who Esther is and what she does and what she accomplishes, you need to compare and to contrast her with Vashti, otherwise we don't really understand who she is and what it is that she does, and for that matter, why she is effective. So again, let's get to the main points just to recall, and then we'll move on. One, Vashti, according to the Gemara, came from royalty. Ahasuerus didn't. He was a stable boy who apparently was the head of a violent takeover. But now, having taken over, he has this wife who is not all that fond of him, to say the least. He's the one who's responsible for her life as she knew it to be destroyed. And that's the background of the situation. As far as he's concerned, she is a conquest, and therefore a true trophy wife, who at some point she makes a decision that I don't want to be a part of this game anymore. I don't want to be used. Yes, we admitted that the rabbinic understanding of this is that he wanted to come without any clothing on. By the way, that's a great costume to come as Vashti. Okay, I didn't really say that. It's a very cheap costume. But I just don't think it's true in terms of the text. I just don't think it's what it said. I think instead of saying that the text says that she... No, it's not that he wanted to humiliate her. Is he wanted to show her off. She was a possession of his that he wanted to show that he now has the queen. But what's really important in the story is that she does have agency and she does make a decision. And there's one way of reading this, which I think is the wrong way, and that is to read it as a feminist story, is that she fights the patriarchy and she fights the men and therefore she wins. And that's not what's going on because it's a class system. She is from the old wealth. She's from the old royalty. And she fights this new disgusting individual who has taken over the country. And at some point, she says no. And when she says no, he doesn't know what to do with it. He doesn't know how to respond because she is this thing, this possession that he's been dreaming about to show off, and what does he do now if he can't show her off? And this is what places him in this terrible position, and it's his advisors who then come and say, you better do something about her. If you leave her without doing anything about it, you're going to cause all the other women who have been taken, and I'm reading into it, taken by force and so on by their new husbands in their new lives, and they're all going to rebel, and you're going to end up having this rebellion. So not only does he listen, he passes a law that all women must listen to their husbands, which is a remarkable thing to have to legislate. I mean, and it's part of that helps us understand the absurdity of the story. The Gemara tells us that the whole story of Megillat Esther can be reduced into a short statement. It's the story of a man who kills his wife because of the advice of his best friend, and then it's a man who kills his best friend because of the advice of his wife, right? And that truly is the whole story, but obviously there are a couple of details along the way that we need to get to. So, the text is also ambivalent by never actually stating clearly what happened to Vashti. And I think the lack of telling us that is because of the ambivalence. On the one hand, how does he get rid of her, but how does he not get rid of her? How does he not kill her, but how does he kill her? And it never says it. Just she disappears, and that's one of these things that in our minds that we know that he killed her, but it just never says it. So again, I want to stress that, because I think it does go back to his feelings. Next point. Esther is seen, and again, I told you last time, that there is a feminist literature about Vashti and about Esther, and Vashti is the hero because she is a strong woman who says no. And Esther is ridiculed and attacked because of her passivity, because she is so passive, because she doesn't do anything, and more important, because she listens. One article I read about it says, oh, Esther's a good girl, and I just don't like her as a strong woman. She's a good girl and does whatever she's told. And part of what I'm going to talk about today is how much that isn't true. Because in order to say that, you have to completely misread the book, and not just misread the book, misread the incredible change in character or development of character, or perhaps her character is revealed along the way. And it's what's revealed about Esther that is what I really want to get to today. But just in order to understand that point a little bit better, Esther is taken. She's taken by Ahasuerus' men. She's taken by Ahasuerus. She is passive all the way till one point, and it's that point that we're really concerned about. So in order to understand what it is that she does, and to understand really her brilliance, what I want to do is repeat something that we did last week, and that was the psychological profile of two main characters, one Ahasuerus and two is Haman. Ahasuerus, as I've already said, is somebody who took the kingdom by force. There's a price that he pays for that. The price that he pays is that he's always worried that there's somebody else in the shadows who's going to try to do to him what he's already done to the previous regime. Which means the price that he pays for having a coup is that he's worried about the next one. And that's something that he can't get past. And it's also going to contribute to his psychological well-being, which is going to deteriorate. So let me read again the description. Paranoid personality disorder is a mental disorder characterized by paranoia and a persuasive long-standing suspicionness and generalized mistrust of others. Individuals with this personality disorder may be hypersensitive, easily feel slighted, and habituate to the world by vigilant scanning of the environment for clues or suggestions that may validate their fears or biases. Paranoid individuals are eager observers. They think they're in danger and look for signs and threats of that danger, potentially not appreciating other evidence. They tend to be guarded and suspicious and have quite constricted emotional lives. The reduced capacity for meaningful emotional involvement and the general pattern of isolated withdrawal often lend a quality of schizoid isolation to their life experience. People with this particular disorder may or may not have a tendency to bear grudges, suspiciousness, tendency to interpret others' actions as hostile, persistent tendency to self-reference, or a tenacious sense of personal right. And as I said again, it's going to get worse. The couple things about him that you need to, again, appreciate. One, if you come to see Ahasuerus without an invitation, you could be sentenced to death. That's how scared he was of somebody showing up where he was not in control. He needs to control who's going to come and see him because he's scared. If he sends out a law, it cannot be withdrawn because he's scared that somebody can do something to it. No, once the law is set, the law is set. And of course, the best part of his paranoia and sense that people are out to get him is the fact that there are people out to get him. And that was evidenced by this assassination attempt, which quite ironically was discovered by Mordechai, who's hanging around the palace because he's concerned about Esther, and he reports it to Esther, who reports it to the king, and it was investigated, and two people were put to death, and he knows there are people out to get him. And that does not make him feel better. Oh, we found those two. That makes him feel much worse. There are people out to get him. And that's part of what his concern will continue to be. So remember this about him. As far as this emotional state, where it's constricted and doesn't have relationships, that is a great read. And I want to remind you about something. One of the things we saw last time was that all the women who were in this contest, and again, there were two options in the contest. Either you win and become queen, or you lose and you spend the rest of your life working for Ahasuerus, sleeping with him whenever he wants. The word which is used is harem. All these women now are in the harem. They don't get to go back and lead regular lives again. So therefore, all of the other women, and this is what we're told, all of the other women in this contest are enthusiastic. The reason I say that is they all ask for their makeup, they all ask for their perfume, they all want to win. There's one woman who doesn't want to win, and she's ambivalent at best, and that's Esther. Esther doesn't ask for anything, and that goes back to Esther's passivity, and Esther is passive in every single aspect of this, and I would imagine that when it came to that night when she was together with Ahasuerus, she was, again, very, very passive, which the Gemara is going to call, and any of you who are in my other class will appreciate this, will say that essentially she was raped, she has no interest in being with him, he takes her by force, and there is this passive element to Esther's relationship with him, and the only thing which we're really struck by is the fact that she wins. Why does she win this contest? And the answer is, because all the other women have proved something. All the other women are enthusiastic, and all the other women want to win, and all the other women, as far as he's concerned, are perfect women to be in his harem. I mean, he meets this woman, okay, good. I'll see you again next Tuesday. You know, I'll take you on a date on Valentine's Day. And you, I mean, but there's one woman who looks different from everybody else. And he interprets this, and that's why I said the comparison or the contrast with Vashti is so important, is that Esther reminds him of somebody else who was in his life, somebody who was a little bit more emotionally distant from him, somebody who didn't throw herself at him, somebody who came off as being very regal, and that's Vashti. So now, when he needs women to sleep with, so there's no limit of the women he has to sleep with, he does not have this problem. In fact, we're going to learn very, very soon that when Mordechai says, you better do something, she says, listen, I haven't even seen him in more than a month. And I'll say it again. He does not need Esther for companionship. He's got plenty of companionship. But he's also into these relationships where there is no emotional relationship. It's just a physical relationship. And therefore, he has all of these women to fulfill any and all of his fantasies, but there is no relationship with any of them. But he has a queen. He's got a queen who, in case he ever needs for some kind of an important royal event, he has his queen with her crown and so on. But there is no real relationship, and I'll say it again. Why does Esther win? Because she's the woman who reminds him the most of Vashti, and that's because of this distance. Okay, and at that point, we can now, again, pause. Let's go back to Haman. Haman was the perfect advisor for Ahasuerus, and what I said about him last time was two things, and I want to try to prove them both today. One of them, I think, is very easy to identify, and that's his narcissism, where his sense of self-importance. But there's another aspect of him, which I am totally convinced that Esther identifies and then will utilize that knowledge. So, and that's his bipolar. And you could say, how do in the world I know he's bipolar? So give me a couple seconds, because that's what I want to really get to today. One, here's the description of his narcissistic personality disorder. Is a personality disorder in which individual is described as being excessively preoccupied with issues of personal adequacy, power, prestige, and vanity. This condition affects 1% of the population. It's a psychopathological disorder characterized by delusional fantasies of power, relevance, and omnipotence. That is Haman, which is... Now, there's another thing about him. Let me just pause for a second. And that is the being. See, bipolar, and I said this last week, everybody sometimes is happy and everybody sometimes is sad. The difference with somebody who has a condition is that when they're happy, they're totally manic. They're just so much happier. But when they're sad, they're just so much sadder, which means they crash or they fly. When Haman flies, he can run the whole country. Ahasuerus has a lot of women to make happy. He's got a lot of drinking he's got to do. He doesn't have the time to be running this country. But a manic Haman is great at running the whole country for him, and that's why he's his perfect advisor. But there's a price you have to pay. What's the price you have to pay? The price is, okay, he's a little narcissistic. People got to bow down to him. Now, we should appreciate that most likely doesn't make Ahasuerus, who's paranoid, all that comfortable, but he knows. You throw him a bone, you get people to bow down to him, and then you have him. You can have Haman do anything that you need for you, but here's this other side to him. His bipolar, previously known as manic depression, is a mental disorder that causes periods of depression, periods of elevated mood. The elevated mood is significant. It is known as mania or hypomania, depending on its severity or whether symptoms of psychosis are present. During mania, an individual behaves or feels abnormally energetic, happy, or irritable. Individuals often make poorly thought out decisions with little regard to the consequences. We're going to see all of this soon. The need for sleep is usually reduced during manic phases. During periods of depression, there may be crying or a negative outlook on life or poor eye contact with others. So, everything is fine, except Esther's life is totally ruined. She now is queen, something she doesn't want. And of course you could say to me, but she doesn't have a choice. And she does have a choice, which is not nice for me to say. What was the choice that she had? Well, she's a replacement of Vashti. She's Vashti 2.0. Vashti made him a choice. But she made a decision. She decided she was not going to play in Achashverosh's game. I mean, we should all realize that Esther could have done the same thing. Esther could have, when she was brought in to see the king, she could have said, drop dead, go to hell. She could have spit at him. She could have scratched him. She could have gone down fighting. She would have been killed. She would have been executed. Now, some of you can say to me, that's not a choice. But of course it's a choice. And the best reason why that's a choice is that's exactly the choice that Vashti made, which gave Esther her opportunity to become queen in the first place. So I'm just saying is that this shadow of Vashti in the background is not an insignificant shadow. It actually helps us understand choices that Esther makes. Nonetheless, we get this sense that Mordechai encourages her and sort of feels that maybe there's a hand of God in all of this. And of course, God's name never appears in the book. There's no prophet. There's no God saying. There's no instructions. And God's silence is really something that we have to deal with throughout the book. And Esther is there. And then we get this wonderful backstory. Backstory is Haman, aside from everything else, is a notorious anti-Semite. One man slights him, and that is Mordechai. Mordechai doesn't bow down to him. And that's a whole good discussion to make. And I don't want to talk about Mordechai today. Maybe, hopefully, we'll talk about Mordechai next week. But Mordechai refuses to bow down, and at that point endangers the entire Jewish people. So you can make a decision. Is that a good choice or a bad choice? I can imagine the front page in certain newspapers, right? Mordechai endangers the entire Jewish people because of his stubborn values and so on and so forth. Why in the world did he do such a thing? But on the other hand, let's think about the other side of this. How much sense does it make is because it happens to be the nationality of Mordechai is that he's a Jew. That's it. Mordechai didn't bow down. I'm going to kill all the Jews. I mean, that's also in total insanity, but that's the situation that we're told about. Now, when Haman approaches Achashverosh, he manipulates him. He says to him the perfect words, which he knows will bother him. He goes, there's a nation who don't really follow your rules. There's a nation that can do damage to you. There are these people that their values are not your values. By the way, during the great drinking party that took place, it said there were people of all kinds of places, and everybody was able to practice their own practices, and nobody cared. Now, Haman comes and says, oh, look at these people. Never says who they are. And Haman says, I got a solution. I'll get rid of this threat to you. That's all you have to say to Achashverosh. There's a threat. Meaning, is Achashverosh a good guy or a bad guy? The fact that he's willing to sign, you know, on the dotted line, allowing genocide to take place, and not even bother asking the identity, who are these people? You know, a different kind of a politician would say, oh, there are people who don't like me? Maybe there's a way to solve this. Maybe I can talk to their representatives. Maybe we can pass a couple of laws. Maybe we can turn enemies into friends. I mean, there are strategies in terms of politics, but that's not what happens. These people are a threat. That's what Haman says. These people are a threat to you. I'll get rid of them for you. Great. I'll even make a donation to the Royal Treasury. Haman does this, makes a donation, and Achashverosh says, this is a win-win. I made some more money. We got rid of these people that don't like me, and a threat was averted, and life is great. So all of this takes place, and he never even tries to figure out who these people are, and it says that him and Haman sit and drink, and everybody else is confused. Everybody else is confused, and these people are celebrating, and genocide is about to take place. So it's at this point the story changes. Mordechai, once again, tells Esther what to do. He goes, you better do something. You better go and do something. And she says, I haven't seen the king in 30 days. He hasn't called me, and you know as well as I do that anybody who goes in without being invited could be killed. And then Mordechai says something which theologically I think is really significant. And she says, listen, God has a covenant with the Jewish people. The Jewish people are going to survive. And whether the word God is in there in the text or not, it's not, but that's what it means. The Jewish people are going to survive. The only question is, will you be a part of it or not? And at that moment, Esther changes. She's a different person. She says to him, okay, you take people and go pray for me. I want you to fast. By the way, the fasting that took place was on Pesach itself. Okay, it's sometimes you don't realize the whole timeline of the story. The major dramatic events of the story of Purim take place on Pesach. The lots that were drawn were for 11 months from then. So Esther says, I'll go in. Everybody fast. By the way, if they fasted that year, it meant there was no Pesach that year. Okay, it says that in the Midrash. There's no Pesach. They're fasting during the Seder. Everybody's fasting because Esther's about to go in. which is another indication of the whole story being upside down, and so on. So at this point, Esther changes. Now she goes in to see the king, and again, she can be killed right now for going in. She walks in, but this time, and now I'm making this up completely, but all of you will know that I'm right. If you disagree with me, you'll tell me. At this point, she does put on makeup. At this point, she does put on perfume. At this point, she smiles at him. At this point, she kind of plays with him a bit. She laughs at his jokes, and she blushes a little bit. And she is absolutely, completely seductive when she comes in. And she puts this part of her personality that Ahasuerus has never seen before. And most likely, it frightens him and it delights him at once. Because he doesn't know what to think. Which means, again, he's a control freak. He needs to control who's coming to see him. She walks by the door. The second she comes, what's going on in his brain? Oh my God, there's a plot. Because that's always what he thinks. Why? Because he's paranoid. So now if there's a plot and she's involved in the plot, now she's afraid he may kill her on the spot, but he can't kill her on the spot. Why not? Because he needs to know what the plot is, what's going on. But on the other hand, she's smiling at him and she is absolutely playing with his fragile male ego because she's never smiled before and now she wants me, but hold it, does she really want me or she really, is there a plot? Okay, but this is a weak, fragile male ego, and she's smiling at him, and part of his brain is saying, ah, she's finally come around. She finally misses me. She wants a little bit more of this. She wants me. She wants me to see her. She wants time with me. But he's still scared, which means in his brain, both of those things are happening simultaneously. Total fear and his ego saying, well, she really wants me right now. And she, I'm going to say it again, is going to have to be seductive and say, I want you. I want you to come over. I don't get to see you anymore. Why don't you make a girl happy? Why don't you spend so much time apart? What's the matter with you? I thought we were going to have a long honeymoon together. But she's never done this before. So I'm going to say it again. He's completely confused, but part of him is saying, wow, you know, finally she knows what she really wants, and that's me. But part of him is frightened. And then she does something else. She says, and when you come and see me tonight, don't forget to bring Haman with you. And at that point, his brain explodes. Why? Because what in the world is going on? What does Haman have to be here for? I thought you wanted to see me. But she does want to see me, but why Haman? And then he starts, and he can't help it. Maybe there's a plot between the two of them. Or maybe it's one of them. And make no mistake about it. He would rather not kill her. He would rather not kill Haman. But if he has to, he'll kill her. If he has to, he'll kill Haman. Because the main part is to him to remain as king. But the second she says bring Haman, he has to be absolutely terrified of what in the world is going on, which means every moment now until, you know, he's looking at his watch every 15 minutes, if he had a watch, okay, he's looking at a sundial every 15 minutes, right? He is absolutely terrified and is anticipating going tonight. Now, what happens to Haman? Well, Haman is our favorite megalomaniac, manic, depressive, bipolar, and he's told that he has an invitation to a personal, you know, very special event of just the king and the queen and him. Now, I don't know if any of you ever read a book by Machiavelli, The Prince, which any time a teacher ever tells you that there's a book that you should read, I know that that means that you'll never read it. But it's a book which is really a classic in terms of advice of political intrigue. Should Haman have gone to that party? Which means Haman, or a normal person, should say to themselves, the king and the queen and me, what is this all about? Why should I really be there? Should I really be there? Should I make an excuse? I mean, and not be there? Meaning, what in the world is going on? But Haman can't do that because he's a narcissist. So what does Haman do instead? Of course, the king and the queen and me. Of course, this makes perfect sense. The three most important people in the kingdom. Of course I should be there. Which means when we get to that party, Esther, again, I want to talk about emotions. How many of you really read emotions well? Any of you? Can you walk in a room and feel what other people are going through? My daughter is great at it. I don't know if she ever learned anything in school, right? She's a little older than you. She's around 22. But she would be able to say, how was school today? She'd go, oh, this girl was upset about that, and the teacher looked a little sad, and this one. She could tell you how everybody was feeling. I don't know if she ever knew whatever was taught, but she is very, very sensitive to how people feel. If you would have observed this meeting, or this dinner that night, or this drinking, that's really what it was, this drinking, Esther walks in, she puts on the makeup, she puts on the perfume, she puts on the nice clothing, right? Hinting towards seductive, but classy. It's got to be someplace on the, you know, on that line. But her inside, she's terrified. Because she knows that all of this can completely get out of control and she may be dead by the end of the evening. She knows this. But she has to put on the good smile. Ahasuerus is totally terrified because he thinks there's a plot and he thinks that somebody may try to kill him and he thinks he may be dead by the end of the evening. So you have two people in there who are putting smiles on, who are drinking, who are part of the party, but their outward, you know, by the way, one of the things on Purim is wear masks and so on. Their outward face does not match their inner feeling of what's taking place. And then you have a third person. The third person, Haman, he's the only one without a mask. With Haman, you see what you see is what you get. He walks in there manic. He walks in there happy. He goes, let's party. Like, what's going on over here? Because as far as he's concerned, this is the way that the world should be. Of course he should be in the palace. Truth is, he actually should be king. But of course he should be in the palace. Everything is great. Life is great. Life is wonderful. So just appreciate the disconnect between the three characters that are there. Esther, who's terrified, Ahasuerus, who's terrified, and Haman, who's having a great time. Now, part of this manipulation which has taken place is that Haman is now as high, as manic as he's ever been. And that's always been a part of it. He also knows that Ahasuerus loves when he's manic because he gets so much accomplished when he's manic. That's why the guy who can run the whole country. And now he's as super manic as he's ever been. Again, flying, drinking, flying, happy. And Ahasuerus can't control himself and he finally says to Esther, what do you want? I'll give you up to half the kingdom. I don't know about you, but I don't believe him for a second. I don't believe he's giving anything, but he's afraid he's going to lose the whole kingdom. He says, what do you want? And she knows that the situation is not there yet. She does not see the opening, but she set something in motion. And what she set in motion is so brilliant, and it's going to work, but she just didn't know yet it's going to work. And therefore, what she does is she says, let's wait till tomorrow. Since she says, give me 24 hours, and tomorrow I'll tell you what it is that I want. One of the two of you come back tomorrow. Now, from that moment on, Esther, again, has to be completely full of also angst, fear, anxiety, and so on. From that moment on, Ahasuerus still knows there's trouble afoot, there's something going on, he doesn't know what it is. He gets triggered. How do I know he gets triggered? Because of what happens next. He can't sleep that night. He can't sleep, and he actually asked to read through all the records because he knows something's going on. Let's go read what happened last time there was a threat. There was an assassination attempt, which means he is totally convinced that there's something going on, and as I said, totally in high anxiety, paranoia mode. Esther is most likely as well incredibly anxious, waiting. But then the person who's going to, of course, save us is going to be Haman. Haman walks out of the palace, and I want to read the description in the Megillah. V'yetze Haman b'yomahu sameach v'tov lev. Haman walks out of the party full of joy, sameach, simcha, joy, v'tov lev, and of good cheer. And why not? Because his life is great. U'karot Haman et Mordechai b'shar melech. But then he sees Mordechai, and when he sees him, v'lo kam v'lo zami menu, he doesn't get up, v'yomalei Haman al Mordechai chema. Mordechai gets filled with anger. Now, when I said that he is bipolar and he's going to crash, he's about to crash. And why is he going to crash? He's going to crash because he's been slighted, which means he's got everything going for him. Mordechai, more than that, is going to be dead within 11 months, but not just Mordechai. Mordechai and his family and his extended family and their extended family, they are all going to be dead very, very soon. And Haman should not care anymore. I mean, he should look at Mordechai and say to him, Mordechai, you're still not getting up. You're still not bowing down. You know, go dig a mass grave. You're all going to be dead soon. 11 months from now, you're all dead. But Haman can't do that. Haman cannot overlook the slight. And a moment ago, he was so happy. A moment ago, it says he's sameach v'tov lev. And now he gets filled of anger and disgust, and I'll say it again, and depression. He comes home. And he calls for people that love him. I mean, he has people who are really Haman supporters, who like him, and his wife. And he speaks about all of his honor and his wealth, Virov Banav, and all the kids that he has, which means he has so many things which work out for him in life. And all of the honor that he has, how he is more important than everyone else in the kingdom. And more than that, when Esther made a party, who does she invite? Her and the king and me. The Gam Lamacharani Karu Alay Mamelch, and tomorrow as well, which means I have all of these reasons to be happy and to be satisfied with life and to be enjoying it. Again, the man has power, he has money, he has respect, he has love. And then he says, and this is the important line, V'kol ze eino shaveli, and everything I have is worthless. And everything I have is worthless to me when one person, one Jew, doesn't bow down to him. You know, how in the world does anybody let one person bother them so much? But by the way, we all do this. We let some people get to us. We let some people get under our skin. We let people turn a good mood into a bad mood. Haman is somebody who is in the best mood ever described in Tanakh, by the way. Samech v'tov lev. There's nobody else who's described that way. And a moment goes by, and he sees Mordechai, who he's already has a death warrant out on him, and he says, everything I have is worthless when I see him. Which means, essentially, we now realize what's happened. He walked into the party. From the moment he got the invitation to the party, he's manic. Whole time during the party, he's manic. Walks out of the party, sees him, he crashes. And his wife says, listen, let me give you some advice. V'kol avav. All of them say, we'll give you advice. And this is what they say. Yesu eitz gavoa chamishim amah. Build gallows that are 50 amot high. Uba boker. And by the way, notice that. And in the morning, emor lamelech, tell the king, v'idlu ad Mordechai, alav, uba mamelech el mishta sameach. And then you'll be happy again. Which means they know that he's bipolar. They, by the way, they may not know the exact words of diagnosis. They know he gets really happy, and then he crashes, and he's crashed now. They say, listen, we know how to cheer you up. Put a plan in motion to kill this Mordechai immediately, and then you'll be happy again. By the way, you notice that they said to him, go in the morning, because that's a normal thing to do. But what happens to him instead? He gets manic. And what happens when he gets manic? He comes to see the king in the middle of the night. Now that, by the way, is a huge mistake. And maybe one of the elements to his downfall, but I want you to appreciate who did this to him. This is part of what Esther did to him. Esther got him to be so manic, and then he ends up crashing, and now once he's manic again, he comes to see the king. At the same time, we're told a continuation, that night the king couldn't sleep. He's laying in bed, and he asked people to read through him all of the records of the king. Tell me about the last assassination attempt. Tell me what people did. And then finds out that there was a Mordechai involved in helping him. He says, what reward did he get? He didn't give him anything. And that's another lesson. You need to reward people who are supportive, people who are loyal. You need to reward loyalty. And he says, okay, we need to do something. At that moment, he's interrupted. Now, if you are a paranoid king and people are not allowed to come and see you without being invited, and somebody is creeping around your bedroom window in the middle of the night, do you realize how bad this is? Which means part of what we read about the description of our narcissistic, or certainly our bipolar, is that they often make poorly thought out decisions with little regard to the consequences. Coming to see the king in the middle of the night is, without being invited, is a really poor idea. He hears noises outside. He's terrified as it is. He's convinced there's an assassination attempt going on. He's reading all the records to try to figure out maybe who or why or what. And then he hears some noise outside. Who is it? And they say, it's Haman. Bring him in. By the way, I hope you realize, at this moment, he doesn't trust Haman. He hasn't trusted Haman from the very moment that Esther said, why don't we have a party, you and bring Haman with you? Because from that moment, he's already been suspicious about Haman. Haman, he's probably watched really carefully at the party the night before. Haman's been manic the whole time. He's really happy. What's he so happy about? At the same time, Haman's being happy versus Ahasuerus's fake happiness. Again, part of being paranoid is that you also get to be a very good read of people because you're so suspicious of them. So he's looking really carefully at Haman, which means what is so brilliant about what Esther did is she diagnoses Haman, she diagnoses Ahasuerus, and she pits one against the other, which means essentially she pits the megalomania and the mania and the of Haman against the paranoia of Ahasuerus, and stands back and waits for them to crash, and hopefully that will be enough. And by the way, it should have happened right there. It should have happened in the middle of the night. It's that the at least on a literary level, it's fascinating that they dragged it out a little bit more, which means what should have happened is he should have said, what should I do for the person who I want to honor? Now again, what's the worst thing you say to a paranoid king? Oh, let them wear the royal clothing. Let them wear the crown. Let them go on the king's horse. I mean, these are really bad things to say to somebody who's worried that somebody wants to take his place. And Haman, who's always, you know, gone a little bit in that direction, make people bow down to him, says all the things that are wrong. He came at the time which is wrong. He shouldn't come in the middle of the night. He shouldn't come uninvited. He shouldn't have been doing any things it is, but he's not in control. He's just not in control of himself anymore. And all of this goes back to Esther pushing certain buttons over there. To continue the story a little bit, when he says, well, you know, give him the royal clothing and the horse and so on and so forth, Ahasuerus then, in my mind, absolutely picks on Haman and he says, okay, go do all of these things and don't forget any of them. By the way, he leaves out the crown. That he can't say. And do all of this for Mordechai HaYehudi, for Mordechai the Jew. And let's also not make no mistake about this. Ahasuerus knows that Haman is an anti-Semite. He maybe never asked who are these people that are going to be killed, but he's heard Haman tell too many Jewish jokes along the way. He's heard him attack Jews too many times. He knows he's anti-Semite. And when he says, you're going to do all these things for Mordechai the Jew, he knew that he just now totally deflated Haman when he says this. By the way, there's a deeper level to all this. Do you remember how we started last week? One of the things that I pointed out was that Haman starts, according to the Gemara, as the stable boy, the one who takes care of the horses for the old king. And now what did he just now turn Haman into? He doesn't say to Haman, see that it's done. He goes, no, you go do it yourself. He just now turned Haman into the stable boy who's going to take care of the horse, who's going to work the horse with Mordechai the Jew riding on the horse, which means that also reversal over here is Ahasuerus expressing his anger towards Haman, maybe even for being invited to the first party, maybe even for showing up in the middle of the night, for saying to give all of these, all the trappings of leadership, of being the king to this individual. But he makes sure, Haman, you know, I'm going to put you in your place. You're just a stable boy. And coming from Ahasuerus, that is really a severe attack. And that's something else that we need to pay attention to. So as I said, the story could have ended then, but it doesn't. Now, if you're Esther and you actually get to the second party, during the second party now, let's start all over again with the emotional state of things. Esther has essentially, she's got one bullet and she shot it. Well, maybe not. Maybe she's about to, but she's already played her hand. She's going to go one step further, but she is very anxious because she has to say something finally. Ahasuerus is going out of his mind because he knows that there's something going on. He just doesn't know who it is. Haman, by this point, is completely deflated because he was humiliated today. You know, the Gemara goes and makes it even stronger, right? You remember the Gemara? The Gemara says is that his daughter thinks that it must be Mordechai, it must be Haman on top of the horse, and it's Mordechai leading it, so she dumps the garbage on top of her father's head, and therefore, literally, he has garbage falling down his head just to make his humiliation even stronger. Because that's a great expression. I don't need the garbage. I mean, he feels that way without it. The very fact that he is leading Mordechai along the streets and he now is taking care of the horse, that's how he feels. Which means, so many times I say this and I keep on repeating myself. When you read a midrash, very often they're expressing a level of truth, not a historical truth, but in this sense, an emotional truth. How does he feel at that moment? He feels as if garbage has been poured on his head, which means when he gets to the party the second night, he is coming completely deflated, completely depressed, which means the night before maybe he drank because he was manic and he was happy and he's the only one that was happy. When he comes to the second party, he's completely deflated, he's not happy, he is sad, he is depressed, and the second party, everybody's drinking, but all of them have a complete, you know, negative vibe to them. And it's at this point, I think, that Esther realizes that a deflated Haman could be taken down. The deflated Haman doesn't have any of the charisma. The deflated Haman is somebody who has no power. And now that she has taken away all of his power, now she goes and says to the king, using the same line that he had used, there's somebody out there who's trying to do bad things to the king, trying to hurt the king, and not only hurt the king, trying to hurt the queen as well. And who is this person? Okay, this is Haman. So at that moment, Ahasuerus should say, I knew it. I knew that Haman is, you know, behind all of these terrible things, and should just kill him. And at that point, we get so disappointed. Because what does Ahasuerus do for the first time in the whole story? He walks outside to get some fresh air, to try to clear his head, to make a smart, informed decision. I mean, here's a man who's been drinking through the whole book, partying the whole time, and now for the first time he wants to clear his head, which means we have just this delay in finally getting rid of Haman. But if you're Esther, now you've shot your bullet. Now you've gone after Haman. And now the king hasn't done anything. So what in the world do you do now? That's it. I mean, there's nothing left for you to do, and it's just you and Haman left in the room. So what happens next? According to the Gemara, it says that, well, according to the text, it says Haman is drunk, depressed and drunk, and he stumbles and he falls on top of her on top of the couch. The way the Gemara phrases it is that there's an angel, we love angels, an angel pushes him. By the way, again, you don't have to take that literally, an angel pushes him. It's that it's like the hand of God in the background helping him drinking and helping him get to this position that he falls down. I found a midrash, an obscure midrash, that says that Esther is lying there in the bed. Now, again, this is this nice Jewish girl. She began this whole story by really not being a quote-unquote sexual being, by being a nice girl. And she finds herself in this beauty contest. She finds herself being used sexually, and then she finds herself having to go in and to see Ahasuerus, and now to dress up, and now to use her sexuality to try to seduce Ahasuerus, but at the same time, to get this whole plan, and now she's lying there, and what in the world is she going to do? So this midrash that I found says that she's lying there in bed, and says that she's strong, and she pulls Haman on top of her, essentially saying, if I have to, again, she would have preferred for Haman to be killed and end all of his plans, but she says, listen, I slept with one pig, I'll sleep with a different pig, let him catch us together, and let him kill both of us, because at this point she doesn't care, which is really important. She's finally, coins the Miss Midrash, has come to the point where Vashti, you know, we meet her at the beginning of the story. You know, who care, just cares about life anymore? It's over. But Ahasuerus walks in, and there's one of the advisors there who also speaks and says, but first he says, are you also going to try to take my queen in the palace? And it's with those words that you now know what his head has been telling him. Even though he's drunk, he has clarity. He realizes it's Haman has not been the help that he thought he was, that Haman is somebody that he needs to separate from, and Haman is really the evil person in the story. Again, I'm not saying that he's a great tzaddik himself, but at that point he realizes who he is. And then some other semi-anonymous person comes in and says, yeah, not only that, but he put up gallows in order to kill Mordechai, the guy who saved your life, which means if you really want clarity on what is good and what is bad, you should have absolute clarity, and at that point take him out and kill him, and that's where the story really ends. But I want to tell you over one other thing, and that's something which is found in a totally Kabbalistic source. It's in the Zohar. And it is repeated in a watered-down fashion that most people have no idea what the real teaching is. I suspect many of us, if not all of us, have heard at some point, maybe one, maybe two, maybe five different times, about, oh, Purim and Yom Kippur are somehow connected. Now, we can even call it on a phonetic level, Yom Kippurim, right? Yom Kippur is never called Yom Kippur in the Torah. It's always called Yom Kippurim. So Yom Kippurim, you got Purim in there, so therefore maybe there's a connection between Purim and Yom Kippur. Or Yom Kippur, Yom Kippurim and Purim. So what exactly is the connection? Or I'm going to say it a little bit stronger. The first time that this source is ever presented, what is it that it says? And I find the source incredible. And it also goes back to my introduction in terms of Vashti being a feminist hero and Esther being seen as somebody who is not all that special. But I think that we've appreciated today Esther's not just this nice little girl who does anything that she's told. She's a sophisticated, brilliant woman who puts a plan in action that totally, you know, again, it's brilliant. And she saves the Jewish people because of her brilliance. But what the Zohar does is it articulates something else. You know, along the way, I also spoke about what was the emotional state. The emotional state of Esther, the emotional state of Achashverosh, the emotional state of Haman, and the psychological and emotional. But what the Zohar does in my mind, I'll tell you what it says in a moment, but what it does in my mind is it identifies the religious state of what her mind is in. Because again, remember what she does. What she does is that she dresses up, puts on the makeup, puts on the perfume, smiles, laughs at his jokes, and does her best to seduce Achashverosh. So listen to the Zohar. The Zohar says, V'yi Yom HaKippurim. And speaking of Yom HaKippurim, right? Yom Kippur. On that day, V'kad ish it kashtat kadmei belevushin shapirin. On that day, the Kohen Gadol puts on beautiful clothing. De'inan levushei kapara. What makes his clothing beautiful? The very clothing of the Kohen Gadol brings about atonement. It creates sitz delay, matznefet delay, avnet delay, and it enumerates all of the different things that the Kohen Gadol wears that all bring about atonement. It talks about the white clothing, the gold clothing. The white is what the Kohen Gadol would wear if he goes into the Holy of Holies. The gold is worn other places. But who's Zimna on that time, the Itkashtat Be'ilen Levushin de Kapara, on the moment that the Kohen Gadol puts on all of the clothing of atonement, Itmarba, the verse applies to him, Vatilbosh Esther Malchut. It applies to him that verse that Esther put on royal clothing. Esther puts on royal clothing before she walks in to see Achashverosh. She doesn't know if she's going to live and doesn't know if she's going to die. It says, Vahon ala'at lefnai v'lefnim. And wearing this clothing, the Kohen Gadol goes into the inner chamber in the Beit HaMikdash. And that's what it says by Esther, that she goes into the inner room of the king. And then she finds favor in his eyes. And that's the secret of remembering the covenant. And then it says, Purim itkaret al shem Yom HaKippurim. And Purim is called because it's connected to Yom Kippur. Do you realize what the Zohar just now said? It says the Kohen Gadol, when he dresses up and puts on royal clothing of atonement, he is then on the level of Esther, who put on the royal clothing to go in and to see the king. And just as she went into this inner sanctum, to this inner place where the king is, and she doesn't know will she live or she die, the Kohen Gadol experiences the same thing when he goes into the inner place, the Kodesh Kodashim, by the Beit Mikdash. But what it's saying over here, in terms of Esther's inner spiritual world, now don't tell me what she did, and don't tell me how she did it, because you can turn the whole story into a story that basically she used her sexuality, she seduced the king, and then she saved the Jewish people, and the Zohar is saying, are you kidding? Her inner world, her spiritual world, she was like the Kohen Gadol walking into the Holy of Holies, trying to save the entire Jewish people. And that's what was going on in terms of her spiritual sense. And that's why Purim and Yom Kippur are connected. And Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol, tries to get to the same spiritual level that Esther's on, because that's what it really means to be a Kohen Gadol. That's what it means to bring about atonement. And that's the level of atonement that was achieved by Purim. And that was what happens every year on Yom Kippur. This is just an unbelievable teaching because, again, I'm going to go back to this feminist concept. You say, oh no, Vashti's really the hero because she fought the patriarchy. Are you kidding me? Esther is the hero because she uses her brilliance, she uses her feminine side, and she uses her intellect, and she uses her spirituality, and she ends up creating this plan to save the entire people. And the proper way, if you want to dress up as Esther for Purim, you should dress up as Esther wearing clothing of the Kohen Gadol, because that's exactly what it's saying to you. It's saying that Esther is the Kohen Gadol, and that's the secret of Purim. The secret of Purim is that she figures out how exactly to defeat evil by virtue of putting two evil forces against one another and watch them crash and burn. So that's as far as I want to get to today. But Lee Nander, next week I want to talk a little bit more about Mordechai and maybe more about Haman, and to get more of what I would call the theological, not in the book, we're finished with the book, but much more the theological background or deeper level of the story. But Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll get to that next time.